Good afternoon. This is the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm Senator Mia Costello, and today's February 11, 2016. With me today, I have Vice Chair Senator Giesel and Senator Stevens. Welcome. The time is 1:35, and today we have three items on our agenda. We're going to be hearing from Michael Schumann, who is a nationally known professional in the field of regional and community economic development, so I'll be introducing him shortly. We will then have the first introduction of Senate Bill 126, small security offerings, and then we will have an introduction of the governor's bill, Senate Bill 108, introduced by the Rules Committee, which is the Alaska Securities Act, which updates part of our statute. So we have first our guest speaker, and I want to introduce Michael Schumann. He is here in Juneau because of the Juneau Economic Development Council has invited him as one of their highlight speakers for their Innovation Summit, which is going on this week. He's internationally recognized in the field of community economic development. Michael received his bachelor's and law degree from Stanford University, and he was instrumental in helping pass the Jobs Act in 2012. Mr. Schumann is going to be introducing a concept to the committee called crowdfunding, and I'm just thrilled that you're here, and I hope you feel warmly welcomed by the committee. And I did want to mention that since your presentation is occurring during an actual standing committee in the legislature, that it will be part of the permanent record, and the presentation will be accessed and available online for those who perhaps missed today or who are watching. You know, this is also televised. So, and I also wanted to welcome Senate President Kevin Meyer. With that, feel free to give your presentation, and I wanted to let members know that as opposed to our other speaker earlier this week, I think questions during the presentation will be helpful, and as you go along, we'll just take questions as they come up.
That's great.
Right.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Costello and other senators. It's really a privilege to be with you today. And I want to really give you my sense about why crowdfunding matters. And I put a picture up there of not my most recent book, but a book that came out about 3 years ago about around called Local Dollars, Local Cents, around local investing. And some of what I'm going to share with you today is really abstracted from that book. I thought a starting place for thinking about the importance of this bill before you would be to talk a little bit about the structure of the Alaskan economy. There's a really very wonderful website out there called youreconomy.org where you can do a variety of calculations, easy calculations, about your economy. And so I, this morning, just did some calculations around the Alaskan economy, and as you can see in this particular graph, something like 65% of the businesses in Alaska are locally owned, or at least 65% of the jobs in the businesses, I should say. And then 12% of the jobs are in non-locally owned enterprises, either parts of chain stores or factories that are connected by some other company. And then a little bit more than 20% is non-commercial, and that's both public sector and nonprofit sector. But one sees that the local business piece of Alaska is quite considerable. The second thing that comes from youreconomy.org is what has happened with jobs in the Alaskan economy between 2008 and 2013. And what this shows is that the local businesses and the non-commercial sector each added about 4% to their total number of jobs, and the non-local businesses took away a little bit more than 4% of their jobs. So we know that the local businesses are the most important contributor to jobs, employment, and I would argue economic growth in the state. this slide here comes from the Harvard Business Review from the summer of 2010, and it's a regression analysis that was performed by two Harvard economists, and the title sort of says it all. It says, more small firms means more jobs. And what they did is they looked at a bunch of different metropolitan areas around the United States, and they could see that there was a correlation between the density of small and local businesses and per capita job growth. And this study from the Federal Reserve in Atlanta sort of took that research one level deeper and determined that per capita income growth is also correlated across the United States with the presence of local and small businesses. And I sort of lay this all out because it really shows how important this sector is for the future of the Alaskan economy. This slide here is about the profit rates. And we sometimes think, well, local businesses are present in our economy, they provide a lot of jobs, but they're not really as dynamic or as profitable as these other companies. But in point of fact, the most recent data available from the U.S. government, Department of the Census, is that the profit rates of sole proprietorships, which most small businesses either are or start out as, are 11 times greater than the profit rates of C corporations, with partnerships falling in between. Now, there's some reasons that those data may not be the best data to rely on, and so I turn to our neighbors to the north or south, to my north, to your south and east in Canada, and the Canadian economy, which in many ways looks like the United States economy, they keep very careful track of profit rates of their firms by size. And their most recent data shows that the highest profit rates are in businesses between 10 and 20 employees, and the lowest profit rates, ironically, are those where Canadians invest all of their money in the Toronto Stock Exchange and firms over 500. So if local businesses are ubiquitous, profitable, competitive, surely the American public, surely the Alaskan public is deeply invested in them. And this slide here is really just a visual. And when I speak to audiences, I usually ask people a series of questions. And I'll ask them, how many, by show of hands, have mindfully done some kind of purchase from a local business, like a local food business, and most of the hands go up. And I'll say, well, how many of you are doing your banking at a local bank or credit union? Most of the hands go up. And then I'll say, how many of you have at least 1% of your pension funds in locally owned business? And all of the hands go down. And what's strange about this is that it reflects the failure of our capital markets to allocate resources toward local and smaller businesses. Because if the capital markets were working effectively, let's put it this way, 65% of the jobs in your economy are in these local businesses. So a properly functioning capital market would put, roughly speaking, 65% of the capital into those businesses. And in fact, almost none of our long-term capital is going in there. And by long-term capital, I mean stocks, bonds, mutual funds, pension funds, and insurance funds, which total about $30 trillion. And the reason for this really can be traced to securities laws that were passed in this country in the 1930s. And those securities laws created, I believe, inadvertently, a situation that I would call investment or investor apartheid. And what I mean by that is that we have two classes of freedoms of investment. One class of freedom for high wealth individuals in the top 1 or 2% by wealth or by income, who are allowed to invest in anything, anytime, no questions asked. For the other 98%, give or take, you can only put a penny in a local business if you have done a thick disclosure document that will often cost you $25,000, $50,000, or $100,000 from an attorney. And we've all seen these documents, and what you typically get is a document that's maybe 100 pages long, 8-point font, all caps letters, and these are documents that very few people actually read, but nevertheless, they are something that we legally require before a business can take a penny. If we were to fix the situation, at least half of our long-term capital would move into smaller businesses from Wall Street. And, you know, that would be about $15 trillion nationally. But for Alaska, that would be $35 billion of additional money coming into Alaskan local business. So, you know, I submit that this is a very important issue, which is how do we overcome the difficulty that we have for helping small businesses deal with these rather significant legal costs of disclosure.
Mr. Schuman, what assumptions were you making? I mean, I think we're all thinking about the fiscal challenge that we face, and we look at that number, and, you know, it's pretty exciting, but I'm just asking, you know, wondering what assumptions were you making?
About the $15 trillion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what the assumption that I'm making is that, well, the size of the long-term capital that we have in securities right now is $30 trillion. And so what I'm saying is that if we assume that roughly, nationally speaking, half of the economy is local business, it's a larger percentage of your economy, but nationally it's 50%, we would see a transfer of $15 trillion if we got the capital markets to work properly. Now, that's long term.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just pointing out that Alaska's chunk of that on a per capita basis is $35
billion.
Sure. Senator Meyer.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I mentioned
earlier that the previous speaker we had this week, we asked for the presentation and then questions, but we're welcoming questions throughout.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Okay, just help me out. How are we defining local business?
Right. So in this case...
Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
Like a McDonald's could be locally owned, but obviously part of the money is going back to Chicago or wherever.
Right. So the you can define local in a variety of different ways. This website that I was using these data from, youreconomy.org, is drawn from Dun & Bradstreet data. And the way they define local is, does the establishment have a headquarters in your state? And if you have those two things together, it is considered a local company.
Okay, that makes sense. You know, if I can follow up, some of our native corporations actually are global, but their headquarters are, for the most part, here in the state. So that would be a local.
Yeah, and so and it's important to point out that what I'm talking about here is ownership, and that a local business that is successful will certainly will market its goods and services worldwide. So it's not just focus on local markets.
Okay,
so the next point that I was going to make is that you don't need a huge shift of resources in order to make a big difference in your economy. So in 2010, I was commissioned by the city and region of Cleveland to do a study with two other people about what would be the impacts of a 25% shift of food purchasing toward local food. And using sort of the conventional tools of economic development, namely an in-plan regional input-output model, we calculated that this 25% shift would create about 27,000 new jobs for the region, in principle re-employing 1 out of 7 unemployed people there, and would add $126 million to the tax base there. And the cost of doing this, from a capital standpoint, we estimated would be about $750 million. Now, $750 million sounds like a lot of money, except it turns out to be 1% of what Clevelanders have in their bank accounts in short-term savings, and then about 0.25% of what Clevelanders have in their pension funds. So the point that I'm making here is that one should never let perfection be the enemy of the good, and that even the very modest shift of capital to smaller businesses, given their job creation potential, could have an enormous impact on the Alaskan economy. Now, I do want to point out that the securities laws that we have been dealing with created difficulty for businesses to get capital for a very good reason. We didn't want people to be defrauded. And the way that it is usually framed is that we don't want grandma to buy swampland in Florida. And certainly when Bernie Madoff was discovered to have created a multi-billion dollar pyramid scheme, many of us were reminded that fraud is alive and well, and we have to be mindful of it. But I will tell you that when I leave Juneau tomorrow, I will be flying to St. Louis, where my mother lives. She's turning 93, and I'm taking her out to dinner for her birthday. But where she insists that we go to dinner whenever I see her is at the local casino. And when my mother walks through the door at the casino where she loves to spend her leisure time, do they ever ask her, "Excuse me, Mrs. Schumann, but are you an accredited gambler?" And that question never arises. When she sits down and plays blackjack, do they give her a thick booklet and say, "Here are all the risks you're going to face playing blackjack. Please read this and sign before you start playing." So what this is a reminder of is that we have two systems of risk management in this country. One system called gambling, where everyone is invited to play, and you may lose everything. In fact, if you gamble all the time, you will lose everything, independent of your income. And then we have this other system called investing in your community and your state, trying to help small businesses flourish. And unless you pay attorneys $25,000 to $100,000 for disclosure documents that few people are ever going to read, you can't play. That to me seemed not like a very smart system. So I have to say, in 2009, I wrote a piece for a journal of the Federal Reserve in San Francisco pointing out these contradictions and making what I regarded as a kind of heretical suggestion that there might be a $100 exemption in the law that anyone could make a $100 investment in anything with no lawyers whatsoever. And as a lawyer, I tell you, I thought a lawyer-free zone would be a good idea. Now, what was interesting is that following that article, there was a law firm in San Francisco that filed a rulemaking petition to the Securities and Exchange Commission, and about, I don't know, 500-600 letters of support poured into the SEC. And there were similar proposals that also came into the SEC around this time. And as one might guess, what did the SEC do with this? Absolutely nothing. And it was 2 years later when the Government Operations Committee, then chaired by Darrell Issa, had Mary Shapiro, who's, you know, sitting before you here in the picture, and asked her whatever became of that $100 exemption. She kind of hemmed and hawed and said, "Well, we get these silly proposals for reform all the time, and maybe we'll put together a committee and start looking at this." So you have to understand that this is 2011, and the unemployment rate in the country is 10%. And the way everyone on the committee heard her commentary is, we don't care about small business. This is not what we focus on. And this committee went ballistic. And what happened next was astonishing, because a committee that was so driven by political division, you know, basically Tea Party Republicans and Occupy Wall Street Democrats, for the first time that year, they agreed unanimously on something. And that was to do not a $100 exemption, but a $10,000 exemption. And that was led by the guy in picture in the middle, Patrick McHenry, who's, I think, third-ranking Republican in the House right now. Went to the Senate. The Senate whittled it down to $2,000. And then President Obama signed the JOBS Act in 2012. And this is a picture I took from the Rose Garden. It was the only time I ever made it to the Rose Garden.
It's a beautiful picture. Is this your iPhone?
Yes, this is my iPhone.
Very impressive.
Yes. And this is my colleague, Jenny Kasson, talking with Congressman McHenry after passage. And the JOBS Act basically says that we're going to make it easier for small businesses to raise up to $1 million. We're going to allow every American to put as much as $2,000 per company per year and make that level a little bit larger if they have some more income. It also required that people go to a portal, a community portal, a sort of web-based intermediary that would be licensed by the SEC and overseen by FINRA. And it also envisioned that there would be...
Mr. Shulman, what is FINRA?
FINRA. FINRA is the, I'm going to get it wrong, financial something, it's the financial oversight organization within the sector. It's a private sector policing operation to keep standards high.
Thank you.
I will have to remember what it stands for, though. And then the last point is that it envisioned preemption of contradictory state rules to facilitate national issues of securities. What happened next was interesting, because the SEC for 3 years did nothing. And it was, you know, those of us who were forming companies, forming intermediaries, community portals, all to implement the act, were really tremendously undercut by this, because we had anticipated that this act would be implemented rather quickly. In fact, the mandate within the legislation was that it be implemented at the end of 2012. So what happened next is that a bunch of states said, you know what, we are going to take advantage of our authority under the Securities Act of 1933, which permits the issuance and the regulation of intrastate investing, and we as states are going to take our own initiative and create our own versions of the JOBS Act. And this map here summarizes what is the case right now, which is that 30 states, as of today, have passed some form of the JOBS Act. In Alaska, California, and several other states are in yellow, and these are all states where legislation has been introduced and is pending but has not yet passed. So I guess all of this is a way of saying that you are in very good company, that lots of states have acted on this. And I should, and a sort of interesting footnote is that the federal government did finally implement the JOBS Act about 2 months ago. But the way that they implemented it is that there are additional guidelines that have to come from the SEC and from FINRA. So the estimate is that effectively the federal law will not be available until, I guess, late spring of 2016. What I would say, nevertheless, is that there are certain advantages that a small business would have in using the federal law, and certain advantages that a small business would have in using the state law. And personally, I think that one reason for having the state option in front of people is that These state-based systems will have, I would predict, less fraud than the national system. Because when people within a state are looking at companies that they're thinking of putting money into, chances are very good they will have some personal connection to those companies. They will know the management, they will know the product, the service, whereas if they're investing several hundred or thousand miles away, it's going to be tricky for them to do that kind of ground truthing. The legislation before you today is a little bit different.
Mr. Schuman, just for the record, I wanted to mention that the committee hasn't had the bill introduced yet, but it's the next thing on the agenda.
Yes.
So
okay.
Perhaps just maybe talk about
the idea.
Yes. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. So the idea of the legislation before you, that may be before you, is like the federal law. It envisions $1 million as a limit on what small businesses can take in investment. But unlike the federal law, which limits people to $2,000 per company per year, your law envisions up to $7,500 per person per company per year. It also allows, and this is very significant, solicitation, which means that within the state of Alaska, companies can advertise and encourage people to buy their securities. And it, like the federal law, allows an intermediary. The federal law actually requires a web-based intermediary for these purchases to take place. Your law, your proposed law, as I understand it, just simply allows it. And let me just stop there and just open it up for discussion.
I'm sure the members are forming their questions because this is a relatively new concept for folks. But my question is about other countries. Is this something, I mean, I know you worked on the Jobs Act, and I'd be interested to know what you learned through that process. And then are there other countries that have used this model? And can you talk about that? I mean, is the U.S. the first? Can you put that into context for us?
Yeah. So there's only some countries that I've been familiar with studying the field, and I would say the Canadians are sort of moving at a similar pace that we are, and like the United States, they give some authority to their provinces to play with the law for local transactions. So there are certain provinces that not only have done crowdfunding reform, but have also done, I think, interesting reforms around investment companies, around co-ops, and around tax credits that encourage people to do local investing. In Australia, where I've worked a couple of years now and I'm going in 2 weeks, they have a commission, a national commission, which is going to be doing a big crowdfunding reform shortly. So there's still a big discussion, and no specific legislation has been approved yet. I know that the Germans and the British, they have some crowdfunding reforms, and their securities laws look a little bit different. But those are the big countries that I've looked at.
And I think that when I talk to people, I think there's some familiarity with sites like Kickstarter and things like that. But can you explain to the committee what is a Kickstarter or a site like that versus what we're talking about here? How do they differ? And what does that look like in terms of maybe for folks who are familiar with that kind of a model?
So let me start my answer by defining what a security is. So a security is a piece of paper or an agreement by which you will get some kind of significant rate of return from your agreement. And some forms of crowdfunding are considered not to relate to securities, and some forms are. So I would say that crowdfunding really comes in four different flavors. So the first flavor is Kickstarter, which is donation crowdfunding. And for example, you may go to a site like Kickstarter, you may see an offering for something like the Brickside Brewery in Michigan, where they're asking for $25,000 to start a new kind of beer. And if you give them a dollar, you get a thank you note. If you give them $25, you get a t-shirt. If you give them $1,000, they might name the beer after you. All of these things, the thank you note, the t-shirt, and the beer name, are not, from the SEC standpoint, regarded as returns on your investment. So these are gifts, and you are receiving tokens in return. So this is outside the domain of securities law. The second flavor is Kiva.org. And Kiva is the electronic equivalent of the Grameen Bank. So the Grameen Bank was started by the Nobel Prize winner Muhammad Yunus around microfinance 25 years ago in Bangladesh. And following up that, you can go to Kiva, you can find a micro-entrepreneur in, say, Bolivia, and if you love what she's doing, you can lend her $100, and you only get your $100 paid back, your principal paid back. There is no interest. And so without there being interest, this also is not a security. So Kiva is not covered by the securities laws. The third flavor is crowdfunding that relates to lending that where actually you do get interest. And that would be sites like Prosper or the Lending Club. And these things are securities. Unaccredited investors are allowed to participate in Prosper and the Lending Club with some rules about how much money they can put in there. But those companies literally did $4 or $5 million worth of securities work to facilitate those transactions. So what hasn't really happened until the Jobs Act was the fourth flavor, which is where we get to equity crowdfunding. And it's worth saying that the Jobs Act and most of the state reforms really envision all kinds of securities instruments. So it could be equity, it could be debt, it could be royalty, it could be things that are combinations like a debt that ultimately switches into an equity. So they are deliberately designed to be quite flexible. But we really are at the beginning of all of this. And one other point I want to make is that even though 30 states have implemented this law, within those states there hasn't been a lot of activity yet. And I think one of the things that's important to think about is what are the follow-on kinds of activities that really are helpful in educating investors and businesses in the state about how to take advantage of this legal opportunity.
Thank you for that. I appreciate you going through the different types. So in the states that have actually implemented something, equity crowdfunding, is there a state that you can point to that's doing it the way that, you think it should be done? I mean, there's obviously, we pass a lot of laws in the legislature, and I think it's an interesting concept. I mean, I'd say most of them are just the administration needs them, or perhaps those who are in the know will be affected by them. But if you're talking about the local economy, I mean, this is something that anybody could take advantage of. So how do states communicate this type of opportunity?
Right. So I think the best example of a state that has been implementing this well is in Oregon. And a woman there named Amy Pearl, who runs a incubator based in Portland called Hatch Innovation, she actually led the conversation with the State Department of Securities to not revise the law. They assumed that the law was, as it existed, was broad enough to facilitate just a change in regulations. So she worked with the Department of Securities to get new regulations to allow crowdfunding, but then she took the initiative to start going town to town to do this education. So the state has been very supportive of her, not financially, but just understood, and I think, you know, has that understanding and that tacit support has actually allowed Amy to get support from private foundations and others to do this kind of education. So I think that's one way of thinking about this. The second thing that I would say is, and this is a tricky thing because almost all these states implemented their law prior to the federal government implementing the Jobs Act. So they were operating a little bit in the dark. Now that the Jobs Act has been implemented, you are the first state that I'm aware of that actually is thinking of passing legislation with a clear federal structure out there.
And I appreciate that because I've been holding back on the bill. We've been waiting for the you know, Securities Exchange Commission to make their move, and so that's the timing aspect of it. So it's interesting that, you know, we did watch a lot of states go and do this, and then sort of scratched our heads and said, are they going to get in trouble, or right. Is there something they're going to learn? Because I think the fraud aspect that you mentioned is very significant, and that was going to be my next question, is how do you ensure that someone, that the business is legit and that the investments are used in the activities of the business.
Right. So a lot of pieces to that question. I think the first piece to say is just to reiterate what I said earlier, which is that I think that as a state, you have a better shot at preventing fraud than the national system does, because you actually will know the companies or have greater knowledge of the companies, as will investors. And part of what, you know, we have to teach investors is how to actually do some due diligence before putting money into this. One of the advantages of both state and national laws is that it really does limit the ability of people to lose money. So if there is an act of fraud, it's highly improbable that it will bankrupt somebody, but it might hurt somebody. It's useful to remember that securities laws are always an added layer of protection on top of fraud statutes. So, you know, within Alaska, within the United States, there are both, you know, traditions in tort law, and there are statutes that prohibit people from defrauding folks. And so if there is a fraudulent investor, there are always causes of action. And the importance of securities law is to say, well, usually by the time you take that cause of action, you know, that company is gone or bankrupt and the person can't be made whole. So we're going to just add that layer of protection on top of it. I think what your law does and what the federal law does is, you know, there is still some paperwork. There still is some filings that have to be made. And one of the things that I would encourage you to do is think about ways of unifying some of your regulatory requirements with those that are being implemented in the Jobs Act. Because there, you know, for example, there are lists of things that they ask companies to pony up before they are listed on the websites. And it's a pretty good list, not too onerous, and you know, your securities regulators might just say, yeah, we'll just take that list and use it. Another thing that you might think about, and I think this, you know, this is also a helpful way of implementing your act, is the feds will have rules about how to operate a portal. Who can operate a portal, what they can get as a success fee. And rather than try to create your own set of rules around that, why not just simply say to anyone who wants to run a portal in Alaska, you know, just get your license under the federal system and you can issue the Alaskan securities on there.
Okay. Thank you for that. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay. Well, seeing none, I again want to thank you very much and also want to give a shout out to Brian Holst with the Juneau Economic Development Council for bringing you here to Juneau and to Alaska. And it's, you know, I think that it's been very interesting to hear you talk about, you know, how the Jobs Act can be put into practice in a meaningful way in our state, and really excited that you had time to, present in front of the committee. And if members have questions, please, you know, as you think about this, let me know, and we'll figure out a way to get them answered.
All right. Well, you have my contact information up on the screen, so I'm happy to answer any other questions you have. But thank you very much for the privilege.
Oh, excuse me. I think we've drummed up a question from Senator Meyer.
And you may not like this question, but a new business is probably going to be starting up here in Alaska soon. It's already started in Colorado, and in Washington is marijuana. And I was just wondering how, they can't put money in the bank. They can't. That's all cash. How does the federal government going to interact with that? And can people still invest in them like regular companies? Or am I going down wrong?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's not quite my area of expertise, drug law, and how the federal and the state areas overlap. But here's something that I would say, is that I think that any educational campaign around crowdfunding would discourage people from investing in new businesses. That rather you would want to encourage people to invest in expanded businesses with a good track record. Mm-hmm. And to recognize that any new business, whether it is in a new field like marijuana or in a well-established field like, you know, a truck restaurant, those are going to be the riskiest things to put your money into.
Okay.
All right.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you for that. All right. And we'll take a brief at ease as we get ready for the next bill. Thank you. I'd like to welcome Senate Labor and Commerce Committee back to order. Next on our agenda is Senate Bill 126. an act establishing an exemption for the offering and sale of certain securities. It's a very boring title, so I have started calling it the Innovating Alaska Act to see if we could get some more excitement drummed up for this bill. And with me today is my senior staffer, Weston Eiler, who is going to be going through the legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Weston Eiler, staff to Senator Costello. Senate Bill 126 helps Alaskans start and invest in local businesses by enacting a new finance mechanism in state law. The committee just heard about crowd investing, also sometimes referred to as equity crowdfunding. It's a new concept with a very simple premise. Instead of receiving large investments from a few traditional investors, Alaskans who are starting a business could receive small investments from a larger, broader pool of investors. The approach basically lets broad groups of people invest in small businesses in return for equity ownership. We've heard that already, and we've seen it in the state. There are investments in breweries and other small businesses, but not for an equity return. So this basically just allows for Alaskans to take that equity ownership in this small, crowd investing setup. This makes it easier for business startups to get capital to grow. And it also allows average Alaskans to invest in private businesses that they're probably not used to having that option to invest in. The Federal Jobs Act, or Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act of 2012, paved way for this paradigm shift in business creation. What it does is refine some of the more onerous regulations that have historically made it difficult for average Americans to invest in private companies. As Mr. Schumann mentioned previously, some 30 states have adopted a form of crowd investing and crowdfunding on an intrastate level. So I'll clarify that while the SEC is looking at how this would happen on a national setting, other states have used this model to adopt an intrastate option, which is what this bill does. The way that crowd investing usually works is through young companies selling equity shares, often through an online portal to a wide group of investors. Senate Bill 126 would regulate the sale of these types of securities separately from the Alaska Securities Act, and it would add several safeguards to protect investors. These are investments in startup companies, new ideas, fledgling ideas, and so there's a variety of ways in which this bill would regulate these types of security sales and investments differently while still providing a variety of safeguards to Alaskan investors. Under Senate Bill 126, businesses seeking to raise capital through crowdfunding would apply to the Alaska Division of Banking and Securities, and they would have to hold investor funds in escrow in a bank authorized to do business in Alaska. To Senator Meyer's question earlier about kind of the nature of new businesses coming to the state, marijuana and things like that, this is an exemption in statute that entrepreneurs, people looking to issue or grow acquire capital would have to apply and go through the division to access this exemption. So there's still a process by which they'd have to apply, application fees, a review, and a variety of other safeguards that protect both state policy and individual investors. Investments made through crowd investing through Senate Bill 126 would be limited to $7,500 per investor per company per year, and the exemption for an individual company would be $1 million. Both the investor and a business owner would have to be Alaska residents at the time of sale, and there are several other safeguards I might just add, Madam Chair, if I might. In addition to the cap, it, as I mentioned, requires escrow deposit in banks until the funds are acquired for the target amount of offering reached. So basically, when you apply to the department, you are saying you're going to use crowd investing to raise a target amount of capital, and once that is met, those funds could be released from escrow. It also requires investors to sign an agreement acknowledging that these are high-risk investments. That there is a possibility that they could lose their money, that there is a good deal of uncertainty in placing their money in these types of investments. But overall, Madam Chair, I think the benefits of the bill is that business startups are key to growing our state's economy. Enacting crowd investing through Senate Bill 126 is an innovative way to give entrepreneurs an easier access to capital and also allow Alaskans to invest in local businesses in their own community. This provides a whole variety of new opportunities for Alaskans, and it's really just a good way to kind of change the paradigm. And I don't think the expectations are fully known because it's so new, but it changes the paradigm enough to where we could see a great deal of capital going to small business startups in rural areas and also a whole new level of entrepreneurship amongst young startups throughout our state. That said, Madam Chair, I'm happy to take any questions, and that concludes the summary of the bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. Of course, my concern is the investor and how safe it is. And I guess my question would be, prove it to me that it works. I mean, what is the history in Oregon? Have there been lots of losses, lots of gains? Is it a success or failure? Has it returned anything to the investor? I'd like to know what the response is. Has it worked?
Madam Chair, Senator Stevens through the chair, I'd be happy to provide a variety of kind of more success stories or kind of the batting average for this type of investment. In members' packets, I'd also point out that we have a briefing paper, an update from the National Council on State Legislatures, as well as a spreadsheet that shows kind of a status and update of interstate crowdfunding legislation. So we have a little bit of comparative experience from what's been seen in other states. Again, this is still very much a new area of finance, especially on the equity crowdfunding level. And it's in some cases, and I might just speak from the research in preparing for this bill, that I'd echo what Mr. Schumann has said, is that there are a variety of success stories. I think there are a variety of challenges. Again, these are startup businesses that in and of themselves have, you know, difficulty getting off the ground always. That's the nature of commerce and business. But there's also, I guess, just a variety of benefits that have been seen by having this model available, because it's just one tool that's available for investments and also for entrepreneurs starting a business.
Buyer beware, I guess.
Yeah. So my intention, of course, is to hold the bill today, but we do have someone here from the administration. The Division of Banking and Securities Director Kevin Anselm is here, and I'd like to invite her to the table to provide any comments. We do have a few folks online who are interested in testifying. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's my pleasure to be here. My name is Kevin Anselm. I'm the Director of Banking and Securities for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And thank you for allowing me to be here and talk a little bit about crowdfunding. It certainly seems to be the topic of the day. Crowdfunding is being used in a number of states.
And it, while not widely used yet, there are a number of states that have crowdfunding statutes or regulations on their books. And Mr. Eller is absolutely correct. There's not a lot of experience yet. There haven't been a lot of losses relating to crowdfunding, but of course there's always securities losses, and that's why the enforcement piece of that is vitally important, and it's something that our division will be watching closely, and I think that we'll be talking about a little bit in the near future.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Any questions? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is your responsibility to this? What is your what will you be doing now? At one point, I remember hearing that they would apply to your department, somebody that wanted to establish a crowdsourcing fund. Maybe help us understand that a little bit. What you would do?
That is my understanding of the bill. And yes, we've also been looking at the crowdfunding potential, and our expectation is that there would be applications to the department. They'd be relatively simple applications because that's what's intended. And then we'd have to work out the specifics. I will tell you that in looking at what other states are doing, we're looking closely at how Alabama is handling their application process. It's been successful for the last several years, and they've had several successful crowdfunding offerings. And they have very simple application requirements, and we're looking to do that. We'd like to do most of the details and regulations. The reason is so many things change so quickly right now, whether it be the internet or ways of communicating other than intranet or internet. We'd like to be able to change with the financial marketplaces, which are constantly changing, so that we can stay current with them. And the reason for that is quite simple. It's difficult to change the law once it's in place, and sometimes we can't stay current with what actually will work.
If I can follow up.
Senator Stevens.
So would you have any responsibility to actually analyze the business and say this is a reasonable investment or it's a crazy one? Or would you have any responsibility there at all?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, Alaska is currently not what's called a merit review state. It is a disclosure state. And so we would be looking to make sure that there are all of the proper disclosures.
Disclosure, not merit.
Correct.
Okay. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I'm still just a little confused. So if I invest in, let's say, Alaska Brewery over here, Anchorage, Midnight Sun, and I don't know, like Mr. Schumann said, if you give $5,000, maybe they name a beer after you or something. Are you thinking more like actual getting stock, or can it be as simple as naming a beer after you? Or what do you envision as far as my equity ownership if I give this company $5,000 or $7,000?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the way that the crowdfunding is set up, it would be, it's only called crowdfunding if there is some sort of potential for profit. And so if you're just getting a beer named after you, I'm not sure what the potential for profit is unless you can sell your own label. Mm-hmm. But other short of that, if you're expecting a return on the funds, absolutely, that would be a security, and that would be something that we would regulate closely.
Well, certainly. Kevin Zale, that has a good name to it, don't you think?
Yeah, I like that. Make it an IPA, we're on.
Okay.
Okay, hold your horses.
All right.
Well, thank you very much, and I think we'll be looking very closely at this and not be in any hurry. So I do have two folks online who would like to testify, so thank you for testifying today. And oh, Senator Giesel.
Yes, I just had a question for Mr. Eilert.
Sure.
So I'm looking at the bill, and, of course, as I was listening to you, I was thinking, is this a method of crowdfunding the Alaska LNG project? But I see here it can't exceed $1 million and $7,500 per person, so I'm guessing probably not.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, you're correct. In Senate Bill 138, the legislature tasked the Department of Revenue with coming up with basically a proposal report and coming back to the legislature on how average Alaskans could invest in a large diameter AK LNG style pipeline. That is something I'll follow up with the department and see how this could fit in. You know, perhaps there could be some creativity, of course, with the state share, but we'd want to get with the department on the details.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, and I'd like to open public testimony on Senate Bill 126. And online calling in from Kenai is Thomas Daly with High Speed Gear. Thomas, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead and feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and provide your testimony.
All right, thank you very much. I'm Thomas Daly. I reside at 108 Deepwood Court, Kenai, Alaska. My friends call me Randy. That's when I'm talking to you in person. Senator Costello, thank you for introducing Senate Bill 126, the Innovating Alaska Act. I would also like to welcome Michael Schumann to Alaska and thank him for providing his expertise. I would encourage anyone who has not read his books to do so. We all know Alaska faces unparalleled challenges right now. However, for every challenge that presents itself, many more opportunities become available. This bill helps Alaskans with the challenges ahead in a most Alaskan way. When I was a young boy in Tok and got in trouble out in the woods, it wasn't a government program that came to my aid. I wasn't saved by a grant or a well-meaning social program, an angel investor, a low-interest government-backed loan, or even Wall Street. What saved me was a friend's cabin door left open, a supplies cache, or a neighbor that noticed I needed help. This bill will do the same for Alaskan businesses by allowing Alaskans to invest in local Alaskan-owned businesses. Large corporations are not the answer for our state. We have seen multinational corporations come to a community. For every one of those big box jobs, the community loses 1.5 small business jobs. The economic leakage of dollars leaving the community is expanded as profits leave the corporate headquarters outside the state. Then when the market doesn't pan out, multinationals don't stick with the community. In Kenai, we have a vacant Lowe's building. Juneau will soon have a vacant Walmart. The answer for Alaska is to allow Alaskans to invest in small businesses and startups, the greatest job creators in the history of the U.S. economy. When these new businesses buy supplies, services, and support, they will most often buy them from other small Alaskan businesses, spreading and breeding clusters of interrelated businesses that will rise together. Profits will also stay in the state. I encourage our legislature to support and pass SB 126. It really will help innovate Alaska's economy, building a diversified 12-month sustainable future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Daly. Next online, we have Jason Hoke calling in from Glen Allen. Jason, can you hear us?
Yes, ma'am, I can.
Go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee and provide your testimony.
Yes, my name is Jason Hoke. I am the executive director for Copper Valley Development Association, the regional arter out here. I'm calling in support of Senator Costello's bill, SB 126. Thank you, Senator, for putting this forward. I'd like to just say that crowdfunding is another option for businesses in an increasingly difficult funding and financing climate. Out here in rural Alaska, we've got a lot of cottage industries. We have a lot of great ideas, but it's very hard for me as an arter to try and put pieces together for folks to come up with funding and financing besides their own skin in the game. This is just yet another tool in the toolbox for small business startup. This opens up a potential capital stream in rural Alaska. I mean, I'm living in an area the size of Ohio with about 2,300 people in it, okay? So it's very difficult to kind of connect the dots for folks out here. Inversely, it also offers urban investors a broader opportunity to invest in businesses elsewhere in the state. For instance, we have somebody out here who's selling their goods down at the Fifth Avenue Mall to a vendor down there. And they're doing really well at it. And they got their startup from somebody down in Anchorage. Arters have been the local regional champions for economic development and can assist in fostering this crowd investing bill of Senator Costello. We can assist in the paperwork, the filing. We are already partners with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development through statute. And I'd just like to say that I'm very much in favor of this. I've been talking to some of the other arters this morning about this, and this is something that I think is a big help for the state of Alaska and economic development. Also, through the chair to Senator Meyer, I'd like to address your earlier question about naming a beer after yourself. We're starting a distillery out here, and if you'd like to invest, it's made with Alaskan-grown barley. It's sure to turn a profit, and I'll name one after you and former Senator Torgerson, who's also investing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jason. I appreciate your patience. You know, as we heard the bill the first time. So is anyone else here in general who would like to testify on Senate Bill 126? Okay. Anyone else online? I'm actually going to leave the public testimony open for this bill and want to say thank you to Mr. Eiler for presenting it to us. Next on our agenda, we have Senate Bill 108, which was introduced by the request of the governor by the Rules Committee. This is the first hearing. The intention is to hear from the administration, take questions from members, and set the bill aside. And with that, I would like to welcome again Ms. Anselm to the table to introduce the bill.
Good
You want to take a brief at ease? Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. I'd like to welcome Director Kevin Anselm to introduce Senate Bill 108, which was introduced by the Rules Committee by the request of the Governor. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Anselm. I am the Division Director of the Banking and Securities Division in the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. It is my pleasure to talk with you today about the Securities Act, and we seem to all be talking about some of the same things, so that I think will be very helpful for all of us. My presentation will include an overview of the bill. I know it looks daunting, and that's because it's a complete rewrite of the Securities Act. There are a couple of documents that you might find useful as we go through this so that you don't have to try to look through the bill itself. The first is a table of contents. It's about 5 pages, and it also includes some of the most important points, the things that are really changing under this proposed act. So hopefully that will help. And then secondly is a crosswalk that if you really want to see the nitty-gritty, you'll get to see a several column document, and what it talks about is the change of the bill itself is listed on the left, and then the center section notes what has changed, and you'll see that many of the regular provisions stay the same. It's just in a different order. So it's not as hefty as it might look. So what does SB 108 do? It does a couple of things. It recognizes and incorporates the current securities industry terms, which, by the way, this bill hasn't been updated much since the Model Act was originally adopted back in 1959. There have been a few changes over time, including last year, well, 2014, we deleted some requirements for filings for exemptions for friends and family sorts of investments, which we can talk about a little bit more about that. The other big change was in 1999 after the National Securities Market Improvement Act back in 1996. So we want to synthesize our act with other states' laws to make it easier for businesses, entrepreneurs, and investors to understand what their rights are, their responsibilities, and also expand opportunities in Alaska. We, too, want to open up crowdfunding opportunities to Alaskans. But we also need to be detouring investment scams using Alaska entities or harming Alaskans. We want to enhance penalties against those who harm older Alaskans. And finally, we want to separate security statutes from the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act related statutes to reduce confusion between the two acts and increase understanding with both acts. So what does the Alaska Securities Act do now? Basically three things. It allows for the registration of securities. It allows for the registration of the persons and firms that sell securities. And it also allows for actions and penalties against those who would violate the law or defraud Alaskans or both. As I mentioned, the ANCSA provisions will remain unchanged and they'll remain in the current statute, which is 4555. The Securities Act provisions would move to 4556. Of course, there are still references in the proposed Securities Act to the exempt securities transactions for the ANCSA corporations, and those will remain in the Securities Act. Those will work together. So Senate Bill 108 has a new logical and topical format. so that it outlines securities registration requirements generally, covers exemptions from the securities registration requirement, which would include crowdfunding. It licenses or registers firms and salespersons, includes the enforcement provisions, and then there are some new definitions. The other things that it does is it eliminates filings with the division for all exemptions from registration except rescission offers and crowdfunding. So most of the small offering exemptions there will be no paperwork required. Entrepreneurs and others will still have to comply with the law, but no filings are required. It updates the entity and law references, and in fact, you'll be pleased to know that that with this new law, you will take out the references to notice by telegram that I mentioned. It's been a while since we've looked at the law. It does include bad actor disqualifiers. Bad actors used to be called bad boys. There were bad boy provisions. Well, something that we've noticed over time is that gender doesn't really matter. If you're a scammer, you're a scammer. And it all seems to be somewhat equally shared between the genders. And finally, the bill will also improve our enforcement activities, will improve and increase the penalties for those bad actors that take advantage of our Alaskans. And it will also include investor education provisions and a way for funding investor education. And investor would also include entrepreneurs who are investing in their business and inviting our Alaskans to invest in their businesses. I can also brief you on some of the things we're doing already to work with entrepreneurs using the friends and family exemptions that I mentioned and the possibilities for the future. So here's a listing of all of the sections, and I'll just go through those quickly. I know that we're a little short on time. There are 7 articles that are substantive relating to the Alaska Securities Act. The first one updates the securities registration requirements just in language only. It's virtually the same as the current law. Securities exempt from registration includes the same registration and transactional exemptions as the current act, but adds small intrastate securities offerings. That's often what it's called in other states, and this is the crowdfunding provisions. Many of the provisions here are virtually the same as Senator Costello's bill, and I have to tell you that we basically took the language that Senator Costello proposed back in 2013 in House Bill 303. And thank you for that, bringing that to the forefront for Alaska. So I'm not going to go through all of the same things that we just talked about with Senate Bill 126, and at some point we can talk about a few small differences between the two proposals. Article 4 covers broker-dealer, agent, investment advisor licensing, and federal-covered investment advisor licensing. There are a couple of new registration exemptions, one for mergers and acquisition brokers, and this is the buying and selling of businesses. If it doesn't really affect the securities, it doesn't make a lot of sense to require the merger and acquisition broker to go through a bunch of the requirements to become a broker-dealer. So this is something that will make business transactions easier. And secondly, a snowbird exemption that will allow someone who has a second home up here in Alaska to be able to use their broker-dealer in their home state without having to make that broker-dealer register up here. The fraud provisions generally remain the same, but we added one other piece, and this is part of the Model Act of 2002, the qualified immunity clause that will protect someone, a licensee in the business, from defamation suits if they file information that is true with us about that other person's activity. So it's a little bit of a whistleblower sort of protection, not with an extra bump, however, of like the SEC is doing, they're paying whistleblowers. That this provision does not do that. It just keeps them safe from other personal lawsuits. The administration article in 6 does a couple of things. It allows us to develop and implement investor education initiatives with the help of others so that we can take contributions and we can work together to secure grants, et cetera, for that particular purpose. We've had a number of successes doing that. For instance, with the Alaska AARP, we've done some joint grant requests with the Investor Education Protection Funds, and with some of those, we've done some KTOO programs through public television that talk about people's financial issues and problems and concerns, and that's been a great collaboration, but those trust funds are running out, so we need to look at some other ways of getting those funds. So we're proposing that the legislature consider setting aside one-third of the money received through civil penalties into a special fund, but that fund can be appropriated to fund other things, not just investor education. And, you know, there's obviously good reasons for that. For instance, the times we're in right now. We would expect that those funds might be better used for state operations than for investor ed. We'll keep doing investor ed however we can, just like we are right now when those times come. We're also looking at including variable annuity transactions with investors as subject to the Securities Act. I will tell you that there are some concerns out there about that particular provision, so we are in discussion with insurance industry representatives to resolve any concerns. As far as enforcement, the basic provisions remain the same, although we suggest significantly reorganizing and expanding the current law, primarily in the area of increasing civil penalties. Civil penalties right now are limited to $2,500 per violation, or for a group of violations, $25,000. When we have a chance to talk again, I'll be able to go through some of the enforcement cases we've had to show how far behind the times we are at being able to be other than just a cost of doing business for scammers that come into the state of Alaska. We're suggesting that treble damages when a victim is an older Alaskan, and that's already defined in statute, and it's a person 60 years or older. We'd like to include restitution, so that we can order that money be paid back to an investor that's been taken. Right now, that's not we are not capable of doing that through the department. And then finally, that Superior Court can hold a person in violation of a final administrative order subject to a fine, a substantial fine. Right now, that's not in the law. So we're proposing some changes in how the enforcement and legal pieces are structured. First, that civil liability is separated from rescission. Civil liability is pretty easy. Rescission means undoing a transaction and putting people back to where they were before they started. Salespersons who violate the Securities Act are also liable to their clients, who then may recover damages. That liability will be strengthened. And the statute of limitations hasn't changed. It's generally 3 years from the date of sale unless there's fraud, and it typically extends it to 5. There are a couple of changes, and this you're going to see almost a rendition of a particular case that we had here in Alaska. An aggrieved party has 30 days to accept a rescission offer. The offeror must demonstrate ability to pay. We had a situation where someone said, sure, I'll rescind the offer. And then when that was accepted, there was no money. The rescission offer has to be delivered in a way that ensures receipt by the aggrieved person. And then the offeror must actually pay as promised, or there's liability. Criminal enforcement, again, it's pretty much the same as it was before, but increased penalties. So how big is the securities industry in Alaska? Probably bigger than you might think. We have over 1,200 broker-dealers licensed in the state, and those are everything from Merrill Lynch, J. to Edward Jones. We have only one domestic broker-dealer in the state, and that's a relatively new broker-dealer. We have 765 investment advisors that are registered in the state. About 30 of them are domiciled here. And there are over 90,000 salespersons. In fact, the last count I received since we just went through a renewal period is over 92,000 people are registered in the state of Alaska to sell to our citizens. And the reason is, frankly, is we have one of the highest per capita incomes. This is a target state. We're also a long ways away from everything, and so it's more difficult for people to check on what they're investing in or the firms that they're investing with. And we're hoping with investor education to be able to let people know that we're really here at banking and securities, and we can help them with their due diligence to know if the people and the company that they're working for are properly licensed and whether or not they have disciplinary history already. Securities registrations and filings. Believe it or not, we get 6,000 or more mutual fund filings every year. We also get a number of Regulation D filings, and those are the ones that are limited offerings for those that for moneyed investors. We also have about 600 securities registrations and filings. That's gone down since last year because we no longer require those friends and family exemption filings. So, unfortunately, we are also taking enforcement actions, or fortunately. We do get money back for people when we can, and we also issue cease and desist orders, but the maximum we can fine for a number of violations is $25,000. I'll be telling you about a case that originated from people down in Texas, and they took our Alaskan investors for $3.2 million. The maximum fine that we can levy is $25,000 for the various law violations. So that's why we need to talk more about that. The division issued 35 final orders. We do have 11 other programs as well as securities, but nearly half of them were related to securities. So it's a very busy area for us. Most of our orders are posted online. If you're interested in taking a look, you can just look Alaska Division of Banking and Securities. We'll take you directly to the website. And of course, the website's down across the bottom of the slide there. And anything with a dash S is a securities case. And we have many of the cases already on from about 1990 forward. We're also getting some of the older cases on so that people can see what has happened over the years in securities. In Article 7, we're adding a number of new definitions. There are also a number of existing definitions that may have been updated. And finally, I just wanted to leave you with our mission statement, which is to protect consumers of financial services and promote safe and sound financial systems, which supports the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development's mission to promote a healthy economy, support strong communities, and protect consumers in Alaska. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions that...
Thank you, Ms. Anselm. We are just about ready to head out of the committee. I wanted to thank you all for your help and your staff's help in Senate Bill 126. Appreciate that.
Our pleasure.
And we will definitely be looking at the bill and appreciate all the work that has gone into it. It's obviously a significant amount of work, but... we will be looking at that again. And wanted to mention to the committee members, our committee usually meets from 1:30 to 3. So next week we will be meeting from 1:30 to 3:30. I appreciate you your willingness to meet at that time. We will be hearing on Tuesday Senate Bill 131, the alcohol tax proposed as part of the governor's plan, Senate Bill 133, the tobacco tax. And then we will have a meeting from 6 to 8 in the evening to hold public testimony on Tuesday. And then on Thursday, we will hear Senate Bill 134, the passenger vessel tax, Senate Bill 130, and also the individual income tax bill that's been introduced as part of the governor's plan. And then again, we will have public testimony from 6 to 8 in the evening. So also, we will be having an additional meeting Friday from 3:30 to 5 to wrap up any public testimony and hear bills that have been previously heard. So want to thank you for making that extra commitment, and
you know, we definitely have been working hard in this committee. So,
Madam Chair,
yes,
have you sent that schedule out to our staff so we can adjust our calendars accordingly?
Yes, we've been in contact.
Very good. Yeah, because the chair resources Friday 3:35.
For the month of February, we're not meeting on Friday.
Okay.
In resources.
Good. Perfect.
All right. Thank you. Committee is adjourned.